And that brings us to our speaker. Our speaker tonight is local from Regalsville. His name's Frank. Please help me welcome Frank.
My name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic. And that is by far the most important thing I'm going to say all evening, believe me. Because if I forget I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to die, you know. There are a lot of other things I can do and get in a lot of trouble. I know that. I've done that before. But if I forget I'm an alcoholic, I'll die. You know, when Jeff asked me to speak, he didn't spill the beans about the tie until he left it on a voicemail. Oh, by the way, you know, group conscious, you know, it was a nice shirt, tie. You know, but that's okay, you know, because this is the way it was when I first came into the fellowship. I got sober and celebrated an anniversary just the Friday before last, July 24th, 1983. And Regalsville was my home group. And I've been blessed with having a number of home groups because I'm a good alcoholic. I've moved around a lot, you know, here and there. And they say, you know, get settled, get with an alcoholic, get with a home group, and, you know, stay with God. And that's what I've been able to do. I grew up in Jersey. I grew up in a suburb of Newark called Maplewood, New Jersey. It was a beautiful, really, really nice, pleasant suburb. Very ethnic community, a lot of Italians. I mean, my side of the school, there were a lot of Italians, and the other side of the school was totally Jewish, and we had a couple of Irish kids, and I was the only African American. So I didn't know I was black until I was about 11 years old. And it's funny, you know, nobody in the neighborhood even told me. My cousin told me. You know? That's just the way it was, you know. We would ride our bikes around the schoolyard. We would camp out in the backyard. And it was just so safe and so nice. We'd camp out in our backyards in a tent, and one of the fathers would come and bang on the tent, you know, at about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock when it got dark, and give us some soda and some donuts and potato chips, you know. But first we were scared of the boom. And then we would take... We get involved in different things, like we got new odometers for our bicycles, and we try to put as many miles as we could driving around the same street. I was like three houses from the elementary school. And we would drive around this school over and over and over for miles on our bicycles. And I mention all that because those are the things that were important then, and you know, it really wasn't important whether this kid was Italian, this kid was a Jew. This kid was Irish, or I was African American, and it stayed like that all the way to the time where it was like time to start dating. You know, and I went to a junior high school in the other township. It was South Orange because I lived a little bit closer to South Orange, and we didn't have any busing. So I started to hang around with the other black kids, and they told me that I talked like a white boy. You know. So I didn't know how to take that, but I know today that the way I took it was, I'll show you, because that's the way I took things. It was like I would quietly get into this, I'll show you mode, without telling somebody, you know, I'm about to compete with you in some way. I still do those kind of things to this day. For example, you know, I'll be driving down the road and somebody will pass me, and I'll decide, oh, I'm going to race this sucker. And I'll beat him to the next light or something like that. But I never told him I was racing him, you know. So, you know, that kind of competitive spirit still stayed with me. But at any rate, this other guy named Rob moved up from downtown Newark. He was really short, and I was really tall. He looked like Mutt and Jeff. And Rob told me he was going to get me cool. So that's what I wanted to be. That was the most important thing for me to do, was to be cool. So I started hanging out with Cool Rob. So it was Frank and Rob, you know. And we would sit around and fantasize about what we were going to do if we ever got to a party, you know. And then finally we got a chance to go to a party. And I remember a guy passing me a jug. I was about 13 years old, and I was terrified. I was plastered up against the wall. My back was pinned up against the wall. I was like a nervous wreck because there were girls there. And this guy gave me this bottle. And I took a drink. It burned on the way down. It was warm after a while. And then all of a sudden, I got all this courage. You know, that was the beginning, you know, of me, of something doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I remember I danced that night. I got out on the floor, danced. I slow danced with the same girl 3 times and fell in love with her that night, you know. And I really fell in love with her. I mean, it wasn't just I just like liked her. I mean, I fell in love with this girl. I can tell you, her name was Diane Kimbrough. I used to think about her just about every waking moment, you know. I had gotten enough courage to get her phone number, so I had her phone number and everything. And I used to fantasize about how I would talk to her and how I would say things, and she would say, "Oh, Frank, you're so funny," or I would say other things, and she'd say, "Oh man, you are really smart," you know. And everything I said, she just loved, you know, and she just would smile at me, and I could have this picture of her smile. The reality is that I never really saw that girl after that night, ever. I think I might have seen her crossing the street once, but I didn't have enough nerve to speak to her, you know. But that's how good I could fantasize. And I can still fantasize like that. I mean, I have to work not to fantasize like that. You know, I turned 60 this year, so, I forget stuff. Almost lived, Rhubarb, almost lived. Rhubarb told me, he said, I said, you know, they just one of those no-cussing meetings. And he said, yeah, a lot of kids around, you know. But he said that God would help me. And I know God will forgive me if I get carried away, but I'm going to try not to. So I used to fantasize a lot. I can forget things that people told me 5 minutes ago, but I could vividly remember things that never happened. You know? Because I'll go back and get those fantasies again, you know? I might change a little bit, a part here, a part there, you know, just, you know, manipulate how things went. But guess what? In all those fantasies, I benefit. And so, I have to remember that, because I'm going to fast forward all the way to when I first started coming to meetings. I said at a meeting, it was kind of a small meeting and a discussion meeting, which I loved. And I said, "Well, my name is Frank, I'm an alcoholic." It was a discussion meeting, it was a topic. I said, "I think," and a lady pointed to me and said, "Don't think for a year, it'll turn into a plot." And, you know, she was right. Every one of my thoughts has always been attached to a plot, you know, or a scheme. And I have to work for it not to be. I have to remember that and work to try to overcome that. But at any rate, you know, I'm back in this mode where I finally got introduced to booze, and it's working for me. So from that moment on, I drank as often as I possibly could. I drank anything I could get my hands on. As a matter of fact, I became a garbage can instantly, because if you had something that would permit me to escape my emotions or my feelings of insecurity or my little bit of anxiousness or the, you know, little bit of confusion that I was having, or if I was a little bit nervous, or if I was ticked off, you know, if you had something I could take to make those feelings go away, I would take it. And that was to go on and on and on. I went on into high school and was introduced to football, and it permitted me to be something else. I was known as an athlete at that time. It was important because about that same time, you know, it was social unrest. The riots in Newark and every other major city. It was the 60s. And I love the 60s. You know, I do. I think back about the 60s, you know, it's free everything, you know. Or if it wasn't free, you just weren't supposed to get caught taking it. But it was, you know, it was the riots, you know. So you had to have Soul Brother on the side of your car to drive through certain areas and neighborhoods. And I was getting in touch with my ethnicity and my roots, you know. And I was a senior in high school, and all of a sudden I realized there was Vietnam was going on too. So I was either going to go to Vietnam or I was going to go to college. And so I went to my football coach and I said, "Coach, I want to go to college." Nothing in my academic past indicated that I had an interest to go to college. Nada. You know, if the bar was here, I was right there. You know, if I needed a D minus, that's what I got. If I needed a C, that's what I got. And so the coach said, "Well, you want to go to college?" I said, "Yep, I want to go to college." So, you know, and you'll hear about a lot of angels in my life, you know. So this one coach took me up to Springfield, Massachusetts in his car, his time, to try to get accepted into Springfield College, which was a school that majored in phys ed and health, because the person who had really gotten me to do things that I would never have done on my own, the first person that got me to do that outside of my father, was his coach, Coach Pete Cross. And so, but anyways, they took me up to Springfield, Massachusetts. I sent my application in there and rejected. I applied to three schools, and two of them rejected me. The third school, I put all my football clippings in because I made honorable mention All-State and some other recognition. And this school accepted me, Slippery Rock. So I ended up going out to Western PA to Slippery Rock. And I was happy about that. I can remember the summer before I left was that, you know, that summer where, you know, that we were just coming out of the riots and there was just booze everywhere, booze on top of booze. Remember one night we were leaving Montclair trying to get to New York, and we were trying to pass through Newark, and we got pulled over by MPs. You know, they pulled us out of the car, had rifles to our heads, you know, like we were getting ready to initiate some riots, and one guy happened to look down at our feet and said, "Oh, they have sandals on, you know. I don't think they're going to do any rioting with sandals on." But, you know, sometime after that, I would try anything with sandals on or anything else on if I got enough boots, you know. I became transformed, you know. I was like super whatever with enough booze or something. But anyway, you know, So anyways, fast forward, I end up going to college. I went to Slippery Rock. Out of 4,000 students, there were probably about 22 African Americans. And I was just learning how to be black. You know? It's like every time I got to a certain point, it seems like the rules changed. You know what I mean? I'd figure stuff out, and then all of a sudden, you know, in a different arena. So, but it was a familiar arena because I had grown up in an environment like that. So I went back to being an athlete. You know, that was easy for me to do because that's what I knew. And I continued to play football, but by this time I was a full-blown alcoholic. We used to stay up half the night painting with black light ink, you know. So I, you know, there are other things a part of my story. And so then I'd be up in the morning, and then, you know, I don't know whether I'd go to class or not go to class, but then I'd have to get the football practice. I had to get the football practice, so I would go to football practice. And I remember, I first went up there, I was real thin. I was probably about 150 pounds. They beat me up to about 180. You know, when I started all this drawing and staying up all night, I probably went down to 165. And then they put me in a weight program. They beat me up to about 200 pounds. And then I was introduced to something else. I went down to about 170, you know. It was a real roller coaster because I like living in all those worlds. I like fitting in here, fitting in there, you know, depending upon what I was doing, ingesting, inhaling, whatever, you know. That was the crowd I was with. And God's grace. Well, I do have to tell you that I was put on social probation when I was a freshman. And the social probation was extended twice, all the way till I was a senior. And every one of those times it was extended was an event that was related to alcohol. I should also tell you, I was put on academic probation, too. When I got there, I got a 1.62 average. Yeah, I suppose I have a 2.0. And they sent a letter home to my folks. Right before they sent the letter home, I was writing my folks saying, I need to transfer. I want to go to all-black school. You know what I mean? I need to get back in touch with my ethnicity. And they sent a letter saying, we're about to send your son home. And I've always been this oppositional person. So when they said, we're about to kick you out, I said, no, I think I want to stay. You know? And so I got grades good enough to stay. I got a 2.4 average, so I averaged out to a 2.0. I stayed right at that 2.0 the rest of my college time, and I actually graduated on time. And I've always had this kind of oppositional personality. Not that I would always admit it or tell you to your face, but it was opposite of what you were saying or different. You know, if you said green, I said to myself, it's light green. You know? If you said fast, I said, it's not that fast. To myself, you know what I mean? But to you, I might go along with it, especially if you were buying drinks. Like, oh, yeah, it's green. But, so anyways, I graduated from school on time, 1971. I convinced a lady who today is still my wife. We've been married 37 years, and that's a miracle. That's God's grace, too. And she needed to be a part of all the millions of dollars that I was going to make. Oh, I left that little part, because now I was going to be a rock star. I made these right angle changes in my life, over and over, But anyways, I was playing football, did it well. Remember, I was a junior, the scouts came in to recruit this senior running back. He was big, bigger than me, weighed more than me, faster than me. He was good. His name was Jay Wagner. And so, being a decent alcoholic personality, I really showed myself as well as I could in practice. And these guys came up to me and they said, if you can keep your speed up and pick up about 15 or 20 pounds, we'll come back next year and we may be able to talk to you. Well, my alcoholism heard, Frank, you're great. Next year we're going to come back, we're going to offer you this elaborate contract, and you're never going to have to work a day in your life. That's what I heard. And there have been other occasions where people have said stuff, and I've heard it, like, my way, And then I've been educated that it was my way. It really wasn't the way they said it, That's the way I heard it. So anyways, that spring they drafted O.J. Simpson. And so I was really ticked off. So I said, well, heck with football. I'm going to be a rock star. And I made that decision at that time. You see, my parents had seen fit to give me classical piano lessons from age 6 to age 12. So I got a metronome. I bought a Wurlitzer piano, electric piano for $50, and an amplifier. Started getting my chops back and ended up playing in the union with another guy until finally my second year as a senior, I got the chance to join a band and did in Beaver Falls. So now I'm student teaching in Newcastle. I'm enrolled in Slippery Rock and I join a band in Beaver Falls. Now, you don't familiar with that area, but it'd be like Doylestown to Hellertown to Quakertown. All those little windy roads, that's what I was driving all the time, and many times in the blackout. So I graduated, and then I convinced this lady, who I told you about, that she needed to be a part of all the millions of dollars I was going to make because I was going to be a rock star, that she needed to come with me and get a job to support us for a while, just for a while. So, it's amazing, as an alcoholic, you can be very convincing if you believe it. You can sell stuff if you believe it, And a lot of my lies, I really believed them. I believed them. And so, she left school. She came with me. She became a maid at a Holiday Inn. My dad was about to trade in his 62 Cadillac on another car. And we had a car that my parents, God rest their soul, both of them, I'm the only child, and I was spoiled. I mean, they bought me everything in under the sun. They bought me a brand new 68 Grandport Sports Skylark. It was chocolate brown with a light beige three-quarter vinyl roof. Interior was light brown, tan, vinyl. It was a nice car. And we took this car to Beaver Falls, and then I convinced my father, who was about to trade in his car, 62 white Cadillac, on another car. I convinced him to give me that car so that Patty, my wife, would have a car to drive back and forth to work, you know, while I was out in the other car getting jobs for the band. And so he gave me the car. And the car caught alcoholism, you know. Stuff started going wrong on it. I never got it fixed. Matter of fact, the air conditioner broke, so I used to get Patty the other car, and then I would use the Cadillac to go get jobs for the band. We'd get a case of beer and put it in a cooler in the back seat on ice, and every now and then we would open up the lid to the cooler and swing a towel around in the car. That was our air conditioner. But you know, you would think that we were pretty cool driving around in the 62 white Cadillac, until we would pull up and open up the door and all the sweat would just jump out of the car on you. You know, other things would go wrong, like the seat was power seats. And sometimes when things weren't a lot of activities, we would, move the seat back and forth and up and down, you know, for entertainment. You know, that's how I entertain my friends. And one day the seat just broke all the way in the up position. So, you know, I'm kind of tall, right? So not only now with the, you know, sweat jumping all on you, but, you know, people would just start unfolding this. If you opened up the door, I mean, all you saw was knees and elbows because we're all crunched. I remember I traded that car for a glass coffee table when it was all done. And then the dog chewed the coffee table. But anyways, okay, so, you know, it's a story of alcoholism. A lot of things happened, you know. A lot of things I remember. A lot of things I've been told, you know, being reminded of by my wife. I remember, okay, so one day the father of one of the vocals took me to Pittsburgh, said, "You have a degree, you know, you should do something other than just be in the band." And I said, "Well, maybe I'll substitute teach." So he said, "Okay, I'll take you down to Pittsburgh." So he did. He took me down to Pittsburgh to sign up for substitute teaching. And I remember walking into this big ivory tower, and they said, "Okay, the personnel's office is on the second floor." I go up to the second floor. The lady asked me to have a seat. And being oppositional again, it's like, why do I have to sit down? You know, I heard you want teachers. You're looking for teachers. I'm just going to stand here. You sign me up for teaching. I'm going to be on my way. "Would you please have a seat, sir?" Okay. So I sit down, and this guy comes to the door. He opens up the door, and he's smiling, and he's beckoning for me to come in. So I'm thinking, they said they really needed teachers, and they're taking me through all these changes. All I want to do is sign up for substitute teaching. So he says, "Boy, it happens to be your lucky day." Now I'm thinking, if it's my lucky day, it's because I say it's my lucky day, not because you say it's my lucky day, sir. You know, because I got this oppositional personality. But I'm smiling back at him. "Oh, yeah." He says, "Because we just happen to have a job for you." And I'm thinking, "See, you jerk, I don't even want a job. I just want to substitute teach." And he points to a chair and tells me to have a seat. I'm having a seat. And as I sit down, he says, "But it's at a tough school." "Oh, now you don't think I can handle it. Now I want the job." And that's the way I was, you know what I mean? It was like, if I would talk my way into something if I thought you were on the other side of it. I would talk my way out of something if I thought you were on the other side of it. I was just oppositional. I just was that way. So anyways, I stayed, God's grace, I stayed on that job for 13 years. And health and physical educator, taught health. Nutrition. Drug and alcohol abuse. And I coached a number of sports, you know. So after about 3 or 4 months, there in Pittsburgh. Now we're down in Pittsburgh. I had a chance to rejoin this band that I was playing with, because I stopped playing with the band. So I joined the band, I rejoined the band, and that was a 7-year stint chasing that rock stardom. And I have to tell you, like, I had a good time. I had a lot of good times out there. I really do. I did. I really did have a lot of good times out there. And the band that I was in, we ended up getting with a guy who was, he was the lead singer in the Marcells. That's going back a long while. Blue Moon, for any of the old timers. Oh, you're not going to admit it? But anyways, he produced us, and we had put out three 45s, three records, and one with RCA. And the RCA deal, we actually were recording on his label, which was Super M, and we ended up getting an RCA deal because me and the drummer went to New York. That was a story that I really can't share in mixed company. I really can't. So the reality is, we got that deal, and we used to open shows for Nancy Wilson, the Supremes, Diana Ross with them, Earth, Wind & Fire, Graham Central Station. I mean, we had a lot of fun. We were out there, and we opened up a number of shows, and there was a lot of drinking and everything else on the road, and I was still working, so I'm burning the candle on both ends. So by 1973 we had a daughter, and in 1976 we had a son. I remember watching my son be born, and then left the hospital after he was born and rejoined the band in Ohio. And it seemed like wherever I was, I could give my full undivided attention to those people. They became the most important thing to me. So when I was with my wife in the hospital, she was. When I left them and rejoined the band, you know, the band was, and the performing was. I didn't call back to the hospital that night. She had complications. I'm not bragging about that. I'm just saying that alcohol made these requests of me, and I yielded to them. She had complications I wasn't there for, but it all worked out, you know, again, God's grace. In 1976 or 77, one of those 2 years, I was burned out. So, you know, I figured, well, it's got to be the band. It wasn't what I was doing. It was the band, you know. So I quit the band. We had been through about 30 or 40 people. It was just me, the drummer, and the bass player left from the original band that started out. And I started a second job. Sports betting. You can laugh. You can laugh. It was ridiculous. But I convinced myself that I can make a living sports betting. And so what I did was I just traded that nightlife of the band for the nightlife of being in the bar around all those games and drinking. And in 1978, about then, I had buried us financially. Buried us. When I left the band, we had a BMW, Mercedes. I inherited the 12-foot band truck. We lived in about an 8-month-old split-entry house on 3/4 acre in a suburb of Pittsburgh. It was pretty nice. Plus, I was still working. By the time I joined Gamblers Anonymous, I was driving a 1970 Rebel. That was it. And so I remember borrowing money off my retired parents, and my mother saying, okay, I'm going to give you this money, but I'm going to come out and find out what's going on. And it was like, oh my gosh. That remorse, that guilt, that horrible feeling. But I knew that I had lost more money than I was willing to work and earn back. So I had to keep gambling to win it back, because I wasn't going to work and get it back. So, but that was how sick my thinking was, you know. They say it's a purely psychological form of addiction, that you get high off of the adrenaline from placing bets and risking more money than you can afford to lose. And you get addicted to your own adrenaline, and that's what was happening to me. So I joined Gamblers Anonymous, and both of my sponsors in Gamblers Anonymous were also in Alcoholics Anonymous, both of them. And occasionally they would say, well, do you want to go to an AA meeting? Because I would tell them about the stories about my wife telling me that she got, she woke up and I was in the closet looking for the bathroom. Well, you know, it's her problem, you know. She's trying to make me think I'm crazy, that's all, you know. And they say, well, you want to go to a meeting? And I go, no, no, no. And then finally in 1981, I had brought back half of the after hours bar home with me. It was one of those out in a country western bar, right? They call for last call and everybody starts buying six packs. Well, I had already spent every dime that I had. I was broke. So these guys bought all these six packs. They had them laid up on the bar, you know, and it was time to go. And I said, come on, you guys, come on to my house, you know. So about 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm coming out of a blackout. And man, I'm looking around and I'm scared of these people that are in my house. I'm looking over here, there's Big Buck over here, and Rambo over here. And, you know, like, oh my gosh. And my kids and my family asleep upstairs. You know? And so so finally they left at about 6:30, you know. See you. I couldn't go to work. There was no way I could go to work. So I ended up, I had heard from one of my sponsors that there was a noon meeting that day. So I ended up going to that noon meeting. I told my wife, I'm not going to work. I'm going to AA. And that was my alibi. You know, that was my way of, like, getting the pressure off. And at that meeting, I could relate to the speaker. I could relate to the feelings that the speaker was, you know, sharing and the remorse that he had and the compulsion that he had and everything. But I couldn't quit drinking. I wasn't done yet. So I stayed out for 2 more years, and in that 2 more years, more yets came. I remember I moved up out of the house. One day I came home, it was like there was a string attached from my wife's mouth to the doorknob. And when I would turn the doorknob to come home, her mouth would just start going. You know, it was like, oh my God, I just got here, you know what I mean? You've been drinking again. Very good. Yeah. How much you been drinking? 2. 2. But you've been going 6 hours. Yeah. I had a flat tire. You know, the alibis, the lies. I'm not proud of it. It was just what my alcoholism called me to do. So anyways, finally I said, well, you know, if I'm so much of a problem around here and I cause all this confusion, maybe I should just leave. And she said, maybe you should. I was shocked. And then after a few minutes, I thought, you know what, here's your chance. You know, you wanted to get out. You wanted out. You know, all your life you're complaining about people telling you what to do. You know, your parents told you what to do. Your football coaches told you what to do. Police officers occasionally told you what to do. Your wife's telling you, sometimes your kids tell you what to do. Leave. So I did. I said, good, I'm out of here. And I went and I moved in with my buddy in a really bad section of Pittsburgh and slept on his couch. This is what alcoholism convinced me, that I left that nice household with 2 kids and a wife, nice property, moved in, slept on my friend's lumpy couch, and I thought I had arrived. You know, alcoholism had convinced me, you're finally free. You know, good. And so it was about 2 months of that freedom, and I was crawling into this fellowship because I knew that the answer was here. You see, that first meeting had introduced me to a hope of arresting my alcoholism. You know, and I knew that it could happen because I hadn't gambled anymore after I went to Gamblers Anonymous. I'd worked the steps, I worked them up to step 4, and then it was like, you know, the rooms got smoky, chairs got hard, people got on my nerves because I couldn't deal with my alcoholism. So July 23rd, 1983, I was still drinking, drugging. I went to at least 2 or 3 meetings, and then finally I was trying to go to a midnight meeting because I didn't trust myself, and I actually fell asleep. It was about 11:30. I was in my car. I woke up, it was about, I don't know what time, but I ended up going back to my friend's apartment, and the next day, July 24th was a Saturday, I ended up going to the Amberson meeting. And the Amberson meeting is a huge meeting in Pittsburgh, 300 alcoholics. And I went to that meeting, and I felt what you feel when you're around people who extend to you unconditional love and unconditional acceptance. And when people look at you with more respect for you than you have for yourself, and when people look at you with hope and a desire to really help you, I felt all that. And it was wonderful. It was a 10 o'clock in the morning meeting. So that was me. That was my path. And I, you know what? I wanted it. At that point, I wanted it. At that point, I had moved out of my house, and I really felt bad about myself in every way. I had abandoned my family. You know, my dad and mom, you know, had a lot of problems, but he never abandoned us, ever, ever. So I couldn't blame it on the role models that I had. I couldn't blame it on anything other than my desire to be totally irresponsible. And I didn't know about this thing called alcoholism. See, when I first came in, I was maybe just a little bit alcoholic, you know what I mean? And alcoholism comes in through your ears, because the longer I stuck around, the longer I heard, the more alcoholic I became over time. To the point where after a couple of years, I was like very alcoholic. I was like horrendous alcoholic, you know. And now after 26 years, I can see that I was just a garden variety alcoholic. You're just an alcoholic, Frank, that's it, you know. Not a grandiose, horrible alcoholic. You're just an alcoholic. And that was a good lesson for me to learn, that the middle is okay. See, all my life I was trying to peg off the top. And so I grabbed onto the steps with the fervor and the determination that I had used to grab onto alcohol and drugs. And I started grabbing onto the advice that people would give me, and the hope that they gave me, and the unconditional love and support that they gave me. And I got better. I moved back into that house, and we started marriage counseling. And we stayed with marriage counseling for about 6 months, and we're still together 37 years later. Now, I'm not going to tell you that the birds are always tweedly-deeing in our house. Because that ain't true. But you know, when I came in, my son was 7 and my daughter was 10, and she's now just turned 36 and he's 33. They're both happily married and they've given us 2 grandchildren. When I came into the fellowship, they were like little animals. They were really just wild, you know, just wild, because of the insanity they had grown up with. And people told me, don't focus on them, focus on you. You get better, they'll get better. Work the steps, be a better example, be a better dad, be a better husband, be a better example. And I would, yeah, but shut up, Frank. Shut up. We would go out after meetings, and we would drink coffee and laugh. And, you know, we used to go to King's, a place out there that had cinnamon ice cream. And we'd drink coffee and we'd tease the waitress, you know, with corny stuff and laugh. I mean, laugh. And every now and then I would try to say something because, you know, these guys were good. You know, they'd get you, I mean, your sides would be aching. You know, they'd be hitting off of each other. And I would try to say something and they would look at me like, what? Shut up. Just shut up. What do you know? All you know is how to get drunk. Shut up. Okay. And I would. You know, another miracle is that I listened to them. See, I had never listened to people before. I always thought I could either out-talk them, out-think them. You know, I had been taught by Cool Bob, you know? You know, I always said, I can be cool enough and smooth enough to take a radio and leave the music behind, you know? And so, yeah, but that was bullshit, too. Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. So, you know, so I did. I worked the steps. I you know, went sponsor. It was started in the Pittsburgh area, and I think I was on about my third or fourth sponsor after a couple of years, and for different reasons. One of them went out. One of them moved to Chicago. I had the opportunity to look for another job. I got fired. It was funny too. I mean, it was funny to me because my wife was really, really worried about this because we had bills. You know, I bought cars that we couldn't afford. You know, having that champagne taste still, and so I'd gotten fired. But I got 6 months severance. And I would come home, my wife would come home from work, and I'd be out in the backyard trying to learn how to play golf, you know, with those wiffle golf balls, chasing them, you know. And she would scream at me, "What are you doing? What does it look like? You know? Did you find a job today?" No. But, you know, God's grace, I did find a job in Central PA. I went out there, I was there for 4 years, and then a friend told me about a position out here, and I ended up coming out here. I've been here since 1998. I can remember early on, some people wrote to my board of directors, and I went back and I got educated. I went back and got all these certifications. I got my master's degree, principal certificate, curriculum and instruction supervisory certificate, assistant superintendent letter of eligibility, and a superintendent letter of eligibility in 1986. I was awarded a PhD in educational administration. And that's only God's grace and through the people in these fellowships telling me, "You can do this, Frank. You can do it. You can do it." And I would say, "I don't even need this degree. These people are really getting picky and getting on my nerves." "Well, don't get it for you, Frank. Do it for somebody else, all right? Don't always think about yourself all the time." So lo and behold, 1986, I was awarded a PhD. So, I've got credentials. I've got more credentials than I have intelligence. And I started getting all these promotions. So anyways, I end up out here after about a couple of years. Somebody writes an anonymous letter to my board of directors, and they send it to the newspapers, they send it to the Secretary of Education, saying that I was a drunk, a drug addict, a pimp, a numbers runner, and something else. Me. They only got two things wrong. So I can remember one of my board members calling me up saying that, you know, they got this letter, and I said, "Well, who signed that? Who's? They said, "It was anonymous." I said, "Well, So anyways, you know, nothing became of it. And my sponsors had always told me that nothing would ever, no, a lady actually told me, and I was in Pittsburgh area, that no weapons formed against thee shall prosper, you know, it's a promise. And that the other things, that people really can't hurt you, that you can hurt yourself more than people can hurt you if you just stay the course. So anyways, I stayed the course. In 2004, I was helping out a person in the Department of Education, and she ended up leaving. She was the Secretary of Education. In 2004, the governor put his hand on my shoulder and said, you know, because the job was open, and I really didn't want it. I was happy out here. He said, "You ought to take this job." Now, first of all, let me tell you that I was out. I had an aunt in East Orange. I would travel every Friday to go take her. I was her caregiver. So every week I would take her groceries. We had a home health aide, that kind of thing. And I was going to take her stuff, and they said, "The governor wants to see you." I said, "Oh, I'm not even dressed." But I knew what was going on. I did not want the job. It was too much job. So I practiced saying all the way to the Capitol, I said, "I am really flattered by this, but I'm not interested in this position. I'm, you know, totally humbled by it, but I'm not interested." So the governor put his hand on my shoulder and said, "You ought to take this job." So I said, "Yes, sir." But in the back of my mind, what I also said was, because this person had written this letter about me and sent it to my board members and the Secretary of Education,
who are you going to write to now?
So, you know, I only did it for a year because it was never my plan, and I really, you know, just wanted to. I did it. I wanted to do it. I did it, and I left. I came back, and I'm really happy in this district. As I said, my kids grew up. My son will celebrate tomorrow, August 4th. He'll celebrate 6 years of sobriety. You know. And let me tell you that when your child is going astray, there is no heart-wrenching heartbreak like that. When you know your child's in trouble and you can't convince him. And people used to tell me, if you want him to be okay, don't say anything, Frank. Shut up. Again? Yep, shut up. And so he did get sober, and he's celebrating 6 years of sobriety. He's been married a little bit over 6 years. And last October, he gave us our first grandson, Malachi Kai. You know, everything they say about grandkids, it's true. it's just amazing, really. And in April 21st, our daughter gave us a grandson. So we have, this year we got two grandsons. Totally blessed. And I'm really, really saying that I'm standing here is a miracle in many ways. One, because of, you know, I'm an alcoholic. You either die, you know, incarcerated or abstinence, and God's grace and you wonderful people, I'm sober. But in 2007, they found a mass on my liver. And the doctor was smart enough not to want to biopsy it because he said if it's cancerous, it'll go all through your system. So on May 18th, 2007, they ended up going in and cutting off part of my liver, and it was a cancerous liver tumor. After that day, I never had any radiation, no chemo, because everything was cut out. You know, I go back first it was every 3 months, now it's every 6 months to get these MRIs and everything. To see if I'm growing any more tumors, and so far so good. But you're talking about getting a cold shower when they say there's, you know, they start giving you tests. One day I gave 19 vials of blood because they were going to put me on a liver transplant list. And you know, I'm just starting to enjoy my sobriety. You know, I'm able to pay my bills. You know. Got a Porsche in the garage, you know. Two of them. Compulsive. You know. Me? Yep, you. So it's another reminder of how good God is all the time, and how anything is possible if you believe. If I can quiet all the doubts and fears that I have in me long enough to remember who's in charge. And how much I have control over, you know, just my thinking and my actions. And what is it that I should be trying to do? What would God have me do in this situation? Remember that, and then pray for the courage and the strength to do it. You know, then life gets real simple. Then, you know, the kind of the fears go away. You know, that I have no vested interest in yesterday other than to learn from it. I have no fear of tomorrow because it's not even a promise, you know. I've got my hands full today with everything that comes my way. Every minute, if I look at it as my friend Barb Jim says, if I'm going to be an agent for God, then everything that happens, God has sent to me in some way to touch or to share with or to help. Everything that happens to me is either for me to overcome or to learn from, and in some way be of use to another human being, especially if they're struggling. You know, I had people reach out their arms to me in all kinds of situations. As a young child, you know, to go to college, I had really no hope of going to college. As a musician, no real hope of being a musician. As an educator, no real hope of being an administrator. know. And all I did was drink like a pig, you know. Greedy. I had the disease of more. And because of that, you know, somebody, an angel popped up and said that, you know, there's a way out of this. That you can put a plug in the jug. We'll take you by the hand and we'll show you the way. And that's what's happened. You know, nobody has told me what to do because you can't tell an alcoholic anything. We just don't tell well, right? It's just like, walk with me. I'm blessed with really great friends. You know, my friend Lad came with me tonight. You know, we've been hanging out. This is almost like it's a marathon. We started with a Friday night.
72 hours,
yeah. And, you know, I have other friends here. You know, I see my friend Shannon in the back with her two beautiful kids. And I've watched her get sober in the program and enjoyed her kids. Carl's over here to my left. You know, Tom, my new meeting guy twice, Tuesdays, Thursdays. You know, it's just unbelievable the people we meet in here and the strength that we get from them. If you've got a problem, somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous has overcome it, for sure. I mean, when I got this tumor, people put me in touch with other people who had tumors or cancer. And I stuck with them. They said, stick with the winners, you know. Well, I've always loved laughing. Loved laughing. If I'd have come into this fellowship and everybody had an expression on their face like a hemorrhoid, I wouldn't have come back. You know, but there were people laughing, you know. At first I thought there was something in the coffee. But I remember a guy came to this other guy. He says, "You know, I'm getting ready to go, you know, through a divorce." You know? So he said, "Well, I've never been through a divorce. Go talk to so and so." So he goes over and talks to so and so. He said, "I've never been through that, but he has. He'll lead you with his experience through this divorce." And the guy said, "Yep." He says, "Well, you're getting ready to get real spiritual, because she's going to take everything material you have." You know, we don't mince words with each other. You know what I mean? You know, we tell the truth. You know, and sometimes you don't want to hear it. It's like, oh, really? Yep, this is gonna happen. So, you know, I guess I'm supposed to talk for an hour. I'm looking at this thing tick away. Where's Jeff? I got 2.5 more minutes. I can do this. See? I can end early. Jack, I'm just kidding. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, this program has taught me a lot of lessons. It's taught me to be tough enough to fight back, yet tender enough to cry. Human enough to make mistakes, humble enough to admit them. Strong enough to absorb the pain and resilient enough to bounce back and keep moving. It has not always been up, it has not always been down. You know, like I said, I never knew I wanted to get in the middle and stay there, but that's what I want to do these days. You know, I've even started meditating, you know, trying to remove some of this discursive thinking that I have. It can be a distraction to the happiness and the grace that God's given me. And every day is a lesson, you know. Every opportunity that I have to wake up, I thank God, and I hope He's got more work for me. So I thank Jeff very much for asking me, and I thank you all for listening.